You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, Bridging the Gap Between Assessment and Practice, presented by Dr. Simon Morgan, Dr. Kate Wallace, and Dr. Rebecca Locke. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced, and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
Welcome all. Fabulous to have you along. Very excited to have a couple of very prominent medical educators with the RSAGP to talk about the connection between assessment and practice. So we've got Rebecca Locke, who's the National Assessment Advisor for the CCE exam, and Kate Wallace, who's the National Lead Medical Educator for exam support. They are and have been very prominent in the college over the years. And as I said, we're very excited to have them to talk about the exam, but more importantly than that, to talk about the connection between your role as supervisors in practice teaching and your registrar's assessment. Thanks again very much for coming along.
Thanks so much, Simon. As you know, the CCE is the clinical competency exam, and I'm sure that many of you as supervisors are also involved in examining. And for those that aren't, would really love you to come along if you have interest. So I'll put that little plug in there as well. And what we really wanted to do today was look at the links between the clinical competencies that we are assessing in our clinical competency exam and what's going on in practice. So how do you look at your registrar? How do you assess your registrar? How do you give feedback to your registrar? And how does that relate to those competencies that we are looking at in the clinical competency exam? And how might it relate to the workplace-based assessment competencies that you'll start to become familiar with?
We will be spending a little bit of time having a look at the resources that are also available to you in terms of exam support, clinical competency support, and support within the workplace-based assessment framework. So you'll know exactly where to go to work out how to do all of these assessments and know exactly what you're looking for when you're assessing them. I'm just going to give you a quick reminder of what the written exams entail. This is where a lot of the exam support program comes into effect because a lot of the new resources are focused around this, and we'll spend a little bit of time exploring those at the end. So as a quick reminder, there's two written exams. There's the AKT, which is a four-hour multi-choice question exam with 150 questions on it. And then there is the KFP, which is a 26-case exam, which is also 4 hours in length. It's a short answer exam with either the opportunity to write a short answer or to choose from a list of investigations. The AKT is a combination of knowledge base, but also application of that knowledge, whereas the key feature problem exam is about demonstrating clinical reasoning skills. And so it's important that we develop strategies for being able to identify and assess clinical reasoning skills in our learners, and we can do that through that workplace-based assessment framework. So just a quick reminder of the CCE as well. So the CCE, it's a replacement for the OSCE and then the RCE, and we got to the CCE. It's an online exam that's run over 2 weekend sessions, and the candidates are asked to perform in 9 individual cases, 15 minutes duration each. Now, you can't get to the CCE before you've sat and passed both of the written exams. And we just also wanted to remind you that there is a complete suite of resources available to you as supervisors and to any learners, trainees, registrars that are preparing for this exam through the CCE website on the RACGP website. You do need to log in with your RACGP password to be able to access those resources, but they are free to use, contains the rubrics, the tips, all the technical things that you need to be able to sit the exam well as videos, marking criteria, and plenty of practice exam questions. We're encouraging registrars to practice these, not just read through the cases, but to practice them with a partner or with their supervisor so that they're able to watch themselves back, to give themselves feedback, not just getting feedback from their supervisors or their colleagues. So to remind you that we are assessing to a standard, so understanding the standard, so there is a profile of the general practitioner, what we expect a general practitioner to know, understand, embody, be. There is the curriculum for Australian General Practice, and we'll spend a little bit of time exploring that. And then, of course, there's the RACGP education policies and standards. These are the rules to provide fair and equitable education and assessment guidelines, both for anybody who's sitting, but anybody who's also partaking in actually being part of the exam and assessing the exam, the trainees and the candidates as part of the exam. So just to briefly explore the capability profile. So the capability profile, once again, you can get to this via RACGP website/profile of a GP. The reason why I brought this up was to give you a snapshot or a framework to help you as you assess your learner in practice. Now, some of you will have registrars that are functioning as a registrar for the very first time. They've come out of the hospital system. They've been previously working as hospital medical officers. And so they've not had that experience of being the person on the spot making the decision. Some of you will be working with registrars that have been in general practice training for a year and they're preparing for exams. Some of you will be working for registrars that you're putting the finishing touches on getting ready for fellowship. Now, each of these learners will be developing at different paces in different capabilities along the way. Sometimes we have difficulty, though, being able to pitch. Where am I pitching my assessment standards for this particular learner? I know what they're supposed to look like at fellowship, but I can't quite remember where they're at foundation or GPT1 and GPT2. If you're having difficulty remembering or you want something a little bit firmer to anchor where you need to be, I would encourage you to have a look at the capability profile, because that then allows you to go, well, in this particular behavior or if this in professionalism domain, in a leadership or advocacy domain, where would I be expecting my entry to be versus my foundation, consolidation, or fellowship? What's expected for that stage of training? So the next resource that was brought out in 2022, of course, is the curriculum and syllabus. I love this resource. I use it quite regularly, and I'm hoping that many of you will be aware of it already. It is not only the syllabus, which is what is the topics that we're teaching, but the curriculum, which is how we're teaching it, what attitudes and behaviours are we expecting, not just the knowledge that we're expecting from our learners. It's broken into domains. It's also broken into topic areas. So depending on what you're focusing on for your teaching session with your learner, you might choose to use one of the ideas from the curriculum and syllabus to frame your teaching session, to give you some stimulus for thinking or a case to consider. It also has up-to-date Australian-specific resources that you can use with your learner that can help you create contextual understanding. And of course, it's not just about the clinical knowledge. We're also considering, what are the domains outside domain two? How am I going to talk with this patient or this family? What do I need to write in the notes? How do I manage this in a rural context? So we're considering domains as well as context. I would very much encourage you, if you haven't had an explore around the curriculum and syllabus, I would encourage you to, because this is the base level of knowledge and topic breadth that we're expecting from our learners.
Can I just chip in there, Kate? I think many Absolutely. Supervisors might have had experience of previous iterations of the curriculum and possibly felt that it wasn't that accessible or useful a document. And I'd just like to reinforce what you said. This new version of the curriculum is truly excellent. It's very, very accessible. It's quite different to what you've seen in the past, if you have. We're really encouraging registrars to use it in terms of guiding their preparation for the exams. But yeah, as supervisors, you will find it easy to access and really useful. So as somebody who hasn't been involved in its development, but using it with registrars, I can only support Kate's comments about its usability.
And particularly, I think, the items that you can actually use as part of a teaching session or use as a small group activity. It's got some excellent suggestions and resources that you can use.
So, Beck, we're about to talk about the core clinical competencies, so I thought I'd hand over to you at this point.
Yes, and so the core clinical competencies are drawn from both the curriculum and the capability profile.
And whilst these will get a little bit of an update over the next couple of years, they're essentially what we do in clinical practice. These 10 core competencies, there's nothing that we don't do every single day in practice. Each of these competencies is further broken into criteria so we can actually put words around what it is we're assessing. And then beyond the 10 competencies, we also integrate the contexts of rural health and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health within these competencies. And then within each of the criteria or the extra parts that are listed on the competencies, we have what we call behavioural anchors. So what are the actual behaviours or skills that we're looking at, actually broken down into those really observable traits when you're observing a registrar at work? One of the criteria called demonstrating active listening skills, there are several different behavioural anchors or behavioural list of performance list of what we're looking for the registrar to actually do to demonstrate that they have active listening skills. And so there might be several different ways of demonstrating this. And it might be that you're listening attentively, that you're not interrupting the patient or directing their response. It might be that you're using open and closed questions effectively. It might be that you're confirming your understanding by summarising what the patient has described to you. So there are several actual, this is the behaviour that we're looking for that confirms this skill is present. A document like this or a list like this actually lets you go, well, communication and consultation skills, yes, I think my registrar has them, but how do you describe what they might not have, or like that they've actually got that really down pat? And so it allows you to describe in that detail, this is what you're doing well. And you can actually say, I noticed that you were periodically summarizing to ensure that the patient understood that you understood what they were saying. So you can actually use that level of detail for feedback for your registrars as well while you're teaching them and or observing them. So how might we fit this into practice? And it might be that you're undertaking a direct observation and you're thinking, oh, look, today I'm going to focus on, let's say, preventative and population health. We've got a few criteria listed and you might think there might be a focus of a case. Well, how is it that I'm actually watching your registrar? How are they actually helping to motivate the patient to undertake healthy activities? But let's say identifying those opportunities to affect positive change through health education and promotion. And then so what is your registrar or candidate going to do that? So they're providing some actionable lifestyle modification advice. It might be that it's after an injury and they're actually talking around, you know, how they're going to return to work. So not every criteria is relevant to every situation. So it might be that your registrar is talking about travel. And so are you thinking, well, do they need any vaccinations for this? Do you need to give them advice about don't go and pat the monkeys in Bali or whatever it is? And so you can actually say, well, these are the things you achieved. These are the things that you might have done in addition, and actually look through criteria lists to give them very specific behavioural advice on what they're doing well and what they could do differently.
So I figured at this point we might acknowledge the elephant in the room, which is workplace-based assessment and the significant change that that has been to a number of us. And to be honest, it took me a bit of a while to get my head around what is it as a supervisor that I'm expected to do as part of workplace-based assessment, and what has this got to do with the exam, and is this just more stuff that I need to do? And on the surface, it looks like it does. But when you get down into the nitty-gritty of it, a lot of this you will already be doing anyway. It's a framework and a formalization of the processes that you do to risk manage what's happening in your practice as supervisors and to assess the learning of your registrar. So in the first 4 weeks, there's this thing called the Early Assessment for Safety and Learning, otherwise known as the EASL. And part of that is the multi-choice question exam that the registrars will do. The part that you're responsible for as a supervisor is direct observation and daily case reviews for your learners. And what this does is provide a safety net assessment for you as their supervisor to figure out how much supervision does this particular learner need for their learning, as well as for the safety of my practice and my patients. And what that does is shape the supervision plan that you're going to put together for this particular learner. Did you want to make a comment on that, Beth?
Just to reiterate what you just said, that it's actually about protecting the supervisor to make sure that what's always been understood, which is that I am supervising this registrar, and what that means is I'm taking some responsibility for their clinical decisions. And I'm taking responsibility because I feel as a supervisor, they're going to come to me with things that they don't know or things that I need to check in on. And so by undertaking this early assessment and actually observing my registrar a couple of times over those first couple of weeks and reviewing what they're doing in their notes, I can actually be confident that I have done my due diligence of ensuring that I'm actually supervising enough.
Then when we move on to other segments of their training, so GPT 1, 2, 3 and extended skills, you're going to be doing your usual mid and end of term assessments, which you were probably already doing before transition anyway. They're just going to be formalized in the sense that you'll be doing those by Mini CEX, which is a framework for assessment of a directly observed consult, or a clinical case analysis, which could either be a random case analysis or a case-based discussion. We're going to walk you through one of those assessments in a little bit, so you'll be able to see what that looks like and how the competencies relate to that as well. And so you're going to be doing each of those in GPT 1, 2, and 3. I believe you don't have to do those assessments in extended skills. Multi-source feedback is something that happens for registrars in GPT 2. The whole idea is that they've had that first 6 months under their belt. They are comfortable in practice. They're starting to take flight as their registrars. And we're trying to see and get an assessment about how are they fitting in? How are they responding to feedback from people around them? What is it that their colleagues, their patients think of them, not just their clinical acumen? And so your role there will be to facilitate the rollout of that multi-source feedback, which once again, you're given a pack to be able to do that. You don't have to write it all or collate any of the information. It's just about facilitation and distribution as opposed to the actual assessment. And there may be times where you're asked by regional medical educator teams, they may have concerns about a particular registrar that's in your practice. And so they might ask for additional assessments from you, depending on what they need to get some feedback on for their registrars to assess their progress along the training journey. So that's workplace-based assessment in a nutshell.
I wanted to just make one more comment, and that is that people often ask in the clinical exam, well, how are we examining physical examinations? And it now comes down to workplace-based assessment. And when you observe somebody in that mini CEX actually doing a chest examination or undertaking an abdominal examination, you actually will rate them as their supervisor or as an ECT visitor. So the ECT visitors are also going to be doing these assessments, and they will form a much more natural assessment of what the clinician is doing in practice.
So we thought we might take the opportunity to walk you through now.
There's different categories, so it might be your direct observation or your mini CEX or a case-based discussion. We look at the performance of the competency areas. Now, these are exactly the same competency areas that we use in the CCE exam. So all the same things that we do that we examine at the end point. So it's actually bringing a bit of harmony between what we're examining in practice, what we're examining for learning, and what we're examining at the end point of fellowship and what we're examining summatively as the hurdle assessment. So all of those things, like the communication skills, our consultation skills, looking at reasoning, looking at management, looking at decision-making, looking at professional conduct and looking at managing uncertainty. So all of these things, there's that thread that goes through training into the assessment. And so by framing all of your feedback that you give to registrars as you progress through training, you're actually preparing them for those final exams. So if when you do a direct observation of one or two consultations and you say, look, I noticed that you're managing uncertainty, that wasn't a strong point for you. Let's do a teaching session around that down the track and we can look at some of the strategies that I use for that. You're actually then helping them to set themselves up for success when they get to the CCE and we're examining exactly the same competencies.
A little point to make about all of these assessment points is each of those is on a sliding scale. If you go the far right of that sliding scale, that would be that this registrar has reached point of fellowship, where you expect them to be at point of fellowship. So if you've got a GPT-1, most GPT-1s aren't that great at managing uncertainty. So I'd be very surprised if you had them all the way over to that right-hand side of that scale. So really think about if the right-hand side of that scale is where they should be at point of fellowship, marking them appropriately along that scale, depending on, is this entry, is this foundational, is this registrar at consolidation, or are they at that point of fellowship? So that brings together as well that capability profile to understand that this is a journey that this registrar is going to be on, and they're not going to be fully competent in every area right from the get-go with every assessment. We're assessing at point of fellowship, not where they are with their cohort with these sorts of assessments. There is an opportunity also to give some specific feedback to your learner, and this is where we can relate it back to the cohort and their stage of training. So you may have gone through and not marked them at that stage of fellowship for any of the previous competencies. However, you can on your global assessment write some direct feedback that says something along the lines of, if you feel that they're performing at the level of their cohort, you can tell them that, which is, I may not have marked you at fellowship, but I believe you are at the stage you might be functioning at for your level of training. And that's totally appropriate. Of course, any feedback we want our registrars to receive should be constructive and helpful and very clear in terms of the behaviours that you see and what they might want to consider or change or do more of or do less of.
Which again is where you can use those criteria and behavioural anchors mm-hmm. from the competency rubric to be able to say, this is what I saw you doing really well. I didn't notice you doing this. Maybe add some of that in. So it gives you the language to really define which areas your registrar is doing well on and which areas they might be able to improve upon. And that, again, then relates back to what they're trying to achieve as they sit their final exams.
And the last thing to mention there is the flagging system that we've got to be able to raise your concerns about if you've got a registrar that isn't at that level of training that you'd expect them to be. Of course, if you've got no concerns about them, then you're going to tick the green flag. But if you've got moderate or significant concerns, make sure you raise them and raise them early. My other role is in performance management. I don't want to pick up the pieces after a registrar has failed the exam. I'd rather know about them in GPT-1 and GPT-2 so we can right the ship early and see them experience success both in work and in assessment. So if you've got concerns, please tell us so that we can help you help them. Once again, there's also another opportunity to provide specific feedback, and this is about feeding back on learning goals that have been provided previously and whether or not the registrar has been able to achieve those learning goals, but also to document the feedback conversation that you're having with your registrar. So although you're providing a supervision report to the medical educator team or to the RACGP about how your registrar is functioning, this needs to be essentially the documentation of the feedback conversation that you have already had with your registrar. There shouldn't be any surprises both in what we're assessment and also what your registrar should be hearing from you is clear and constructive feedback about how they can change or learning goals that they might want to set next. And of course, relating those back to the behavioural anchors. As an ECT visitor, how do you find out what previous learning goals were set? Look, as an ECT visitor, I'm not sure that you would have access to their previous ECT visits on their TMS. That's not something that I've particularly explored.
I'd be asking the registrar when I arrived.
Show me your last ECT report.
Or just asking them, what are your goals here? Because that would really inform how I'd focus an ECT visit. So if they previously had something that said, look, your consultations are a little bit all over the place, you're not actually following a nice flow, then you can follow that when you're doing your ECT visit and actually be able to concentrate on those criteria in the rubric. So even though you can't see the previous ECT visit, the registrar themselves should be able to see both their learning plan, their goals that they've got there, and any feedback that's come from either previous supervisors or their previous ECT visits. So one thing that I actually really enjoy doing with the registrar is at the start of the ECT visit, actually taking 10 minutes to identify what our goals are for the couple of hours that we're going to spend together. And so I think that's well served.
You probably won't be able to see it under your login, but the idea is for you to get the registrar to log in for you, and you should be able to pull up their ECT visits together so that they're able to go, oh, those were my learning goals from the last visit. I wonder if those are behaviours you're going to be able to see me do and skills that I'll be able to demonstrate for you today. And these were the other ones that I had in mind. So I'd encourage you to get your registrar to log in and potentially view them together. Simon, did you have something to add?
Just to reinforce that point, I think something I've done in the past with teaching visits, which the equivalent for the supervisor is a direct observation activity, is to actually show them those 10 competency areas and actually say, okay, look down this list and where do you see particular deficiencies or areas we'd like to focus? And sometimes it's actually useful to do that in advance rather than identify a gap afterwards for them to say, well, you know, my consultations are a bit disorganized or, you know, sometimes I struggle with explanations. And that can be a really useful prompt. So that's, I think, another way we can use that list.
So what are our tools that help us to teach the skills that are assessed? I think I've come back to this in every teaching session I've ever come to, is this little piece of gold that we have the original writers of here with us, the GPSA booklet on random case analysis. So how you develop reasoning in your learner, which we then assess in those, both the reasoning from a diagnostic point of view and the reasoning from a therapeutic point of view, the two of the 10 competencies. This is the way that I really encourage supervisors to think about how they teach the reasoning, and it's through random case analysis. And so being able to go through some of these questions with your learner.
And of course, there's also a clinical reasoning GP supervisor guide as well, I believe. The registrars are given in their exam preparation webinars right from day one. So they're encouraged to think critically when we're trying to teach them that being a good GP is not passing the exam. Passing the exam is not the goal. Being a good GP is a goal. And a good GP can think critically about what's happening with the patient in front of them and the relationship that is developing. So we're encouraging them to learn from their patients and, of course, thinking about why differentials. Do I understand? Do I know enough to be able to apply this? And thinking outside the clinical, both to preventive health, population health, and to domains 4 and 5. What I haven't mentioned is also those the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander context and the rural health context, which is also important depending on your patient and your location. So I just wanted to reassure you that the messaging that they're getting from an exam support point of view is all about thinking critically and developing reasoning skills. If their reasoning skills are sure, then the exams will not be difficult because they will have the knowledge and the skills to be a great GP and to pass the exams too. Thanks, Simon.
And just to reinforce that we do have a very recently revised clinical reasoning guide. One of the things that it has been added to the new version is a greater focus on management reasoning. So I think you made that point really well, that a lot of people, I think, imagine clinical reasoning is about a good diagnosis, but of course, in general practice, 50% of the time that doesn't occur. So it's equally around how to make sense of the information in the absence of a diagnosis in terms of a plan. If you're interested in hearing more, yes, we've on our YouTube channel and complementing the guide, there is a webinar on clinical reasoning. We're increasingly encouraging registrars locally to watch some of these sessions themselves in preparation for the exams, because they're about how to teach it, but obviously they can take away a lot as well. So thanks, yeah, just to make that point.
It's about being able to justify their management decisions and being able to say, well, this is why I chose this treatment over this treatment, because I was able to tailor it to what was needed for this particular patient in this particular situation. And that's exactly what we're looking for in the clinical exam as well.
Beck did her shameless plug for CCE examiners earlier on. This is my plug, the things that I've been working on in exam support. All of the exam support resources that are available to your registrars, and they're actually also available to you as well. A lot of people will know about the exam support online exam specific information modules that are there for the AKT and the KFP. There's also the introduction to the RSEGP clinical competency exam. That's the equivalent of the ESO module for the CCE. The exam support program, there's a specific KFP module on that, because we all know that the KFP is a little bit of a tricky exam and there's some nuance to being able to answer those questions well. But I also wanted to flag the effective study skills and learning planning module. There was a webinar done recently by Chris and Simon about studying effectively and sticky learning. A lot of those things that Chris and Simon were talking about are embedded within that effective study skills module as well. So that's worth a look for your learner if they're having trouble making their learning stick. Or of course, go to that resource from GPSA as well, because it's gold. And of course, there's also clinical reasoning module. So working through the difference between type 1 automatic illness scripts pattern recognition knowledge and application of reasoning versus our type 2 clinical reasoning that we're expecting our learners to develop if they're coming across an unfamiliar patient scenario. So being able to have some strategy and some structure around that so they can stay safe and still be effective as clinicians as they're working out how to manage uncertainty. Self-assessment progress tests, I flagged this at the beginning of the webinar. These are new as of this year and are ongoing. These are brought out 4 times a year, case question banks that are taken from previous RACGP exams. They are available to all registrars who will be automatically enrolled as they come out each year in March, May, September, and November. You as supervisors or as educators will be able to enroll for them, and each SAPT has 50 AKTs and 8 full KFP cases. I would encourage you to have a go. It might be a long time since you've done the exam, but it's really helpful to put yourself into that scenario of a little bit of pressure. Can I complete this? Can I pass it? Can I do it in time? So each one of these SAPT is designed to be done over 80 minutes if you were doing it timed. And then after you've completed a SAPT, you will then get not only the answers for the AKT or the full marking grid for the KFP, as well as a full explanation for each question about why is something the right answer and why is something else the wrong answer. And so these are supposed to be not only just, let's just do practice questions, because we know our learners just want to do more practice questions, but the real gold is in going through step by step and going through rationale and the explanation for each of the questions, particularly the ones that your learners might have struggled with, to figure out, did I struggle with this case because I didn't get all of the information? Did I struggle with it because I just didn't know the content? Or did I struggle with it because I had difficulty being able to express myself in a way that allowed the examiner to get me the mark? So to get to a SAPT, what you need to do is to go onto GP Learning and to go to the exam tab.
Of all the resources, I mean, and Case listed many excellent ones, these are truly fabulous. The work that's gone into them, they're not just good questions that replicate what's in the exam and therefore provide good practice, but they go through exactly why the answers are correct, why the other answers are not correct, the reasoning behind it, And can I just make that plug as well? I mean, as clinicians practicing in clinical medicine, there it's just interesting to see how we go, but you'll get an absolute sense of what the registrars are dealing with and how you can support them in the exams.
There's exam tips and resources where we give people some guiding principles for how they might structure their study or their attempt, the SAPs themselves, and we've had a discussion forum in the past. Look, each of the iterations are slightly different as we are rolling them out and refining them based on feedback and engagement as we go. But I would encourage you to get in there, have a go.
Can you talk to the pass mark and why there's not a published pass mark for SAPs?
Yeah, it's because the SAPT is an incomplete exam. So if we look at an exam, we're talking about something that's blueprinted. So what do we mean by blueprinting? Blueprinting is the idea that we're sampling from multiple sources right across the curriculum and the syllabus, getting an even spread so that we can have some data to say that this trainee or candidate is competent across a full breadth of general practice knowledge, skills and attitudes and behaviours. So a SAPT, as it's only a portion of the exam, so 50 AKTs is only a third of the actual exam, and 8 KFP cases is just under a third of a KFP exam as well. Clearly, that's not going to be a complete blueprint of a full exam. So that's why we can't give you a pass mark. However, it is reasonable if you go and have a look at the old exam reports, every single exam report will give you what the pass mark is, and it's remarkably consistent what those pass marks tend to be. But I would warn you against getting a gauge on one SAPT alone. I'd really want to have a look at progression along their training, and that's why we open these up to registrars from day one. This is not designed to be preparing for exams. This is designed to be feedback for learning as they progress through their training that just happens to look like preparation for exams, because we all know that assessment drives learning. So if we say this is to get you to pass the exams, they're more likely to engage. And if we get them in, we get them reading the rationales, we get them understanding why something's right and why something's wrong, they're going to be learning as well as assessing. So it sticks better as we go. How's that, Beck?
Perfect.
I think I'm just so pleased to see the way you've pitched this, which isn't the exam being this completely sort of separate entity that's quite removed from day-to-day practice. But in fact, you know, these competencies are the way they're being assessed in a formative way through their training, their practical, as you say, the things that they're dealing with every day, and really overlaying that and considering exam prep is the same thing. And I think it just takes a lot of the mystique away and means that everything you're doing is directly relevant. Can I also just encourage the supervisors on to have a look at the guides that we have that match some of those competency areas on uncertainty, on professionalism? And we've got a recently revamped communication skills toolkit on our resources page, which covers communication and consultation skills. So please have a look at those.
Again, when people are struggling with the clinical competency exam, one of the best resources I point them toward are the GPSA communication guide and the communication skills page, which I have noticed has been recently revamped and looks fantastic. I also tell them about the professionalism little cards, the shades of grey, and also the doctor talk cards for some practical practice exercises on tricky communication areas. And I think they're really wonderful resources. And I really suggest people using them as part of their exam preparation, especially for that, again, the clinical competency exam, because it's the only place that we really do that summative assessment on communication skills. It is heavily weighted to communication and consultation skills. And so if people are struggling in that area, I really do advise them to use those resources.
If you're really concerned about a registrar, I would encourage you to contact their trainer coordinator or their medical educator directly, and you should be able to see that on your ECT visitor profile. Same with confidential comments. In terms of development as an ECT visitor, once again, you can also ask for feedback. I've previously done feedback on ECT visitor reports in the past. And as a medical educator, if I received a request, I'd be more than happy to give you feedback on an ECT report.
I think that is the way to do it. Just do the visit, do the report and seek feedback and say, can I please have some guidance on how this went? Obviously, it's indirect in that they're not observing you. Give the feedback, but I think it can be very powerful. The Shades of Grey cards, they actually, as a kind of entity, don't exist anymore, but very, very recently, they have been transposed into a digital format. They are basically a series of professional and ethical scenarios. Pretty challenging, I must say. So they're not the sort of thing as a supervisor you're going to comfortably be able to inform your registrar of because they're quite chewy in themselves, but something that you and a registrar can talk through. They've been made now available on a digital app called Scenario. And Scenario was launched on the App Store. It's our first ever app. You can go to your favorite app store and have a look, freely download the Scenario app, and it's got some of the Shades of Grey cards there.
There was a question there about performers or advice. So the biggest advice I would say about an ECT visit is feedback for learning. They're not supposed to be scary. They're supposed to be constructive. And of course, we're feeding back the same competencies that you as supervisors are feeding back on. That's what the ECT visitor is feeding back on as well. So it's that consistent messaging about what are the competencies we're expecting them to develop as GPs, and these are the benchmarks and frameworks and that we're going to be using all throughout their training so that when they're getting to those hurdle assessments at the end, there are no surprises. They know what's expected of them, yeah. And they know where to find these behavioural anchors that Beck was talking about before.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to add in is actually using the clinical competency rubric, using some of those behavioural anchors or the performance lists. There's a couple of different language that we use around them, but actually using them to identify what's been done well or what else could be added in to enhance performance is a really non-confrontational way to give feedback. And it allows people to look at that behavior or that skill, and it's broken down into those very bite-sized pieces, which creates a much safer piece of feedback for a registrar. And I think that is something that is very useful as an ECT visitor to have the PDF copy or to have those behavioural, the performance anchors to look at. And the more you do it, the more familiar you'll become with it. And then you'll just want to come and do CTE examining as well.
This is an invitation to join our online community. We've got a recently updated website and you'll see the community tab very prominently at the top. This is a way we're trying to engage GPSA members a little better to join the conversation. So join that if you would like. You've made a couple of plugs about supervisors becoming examiners. I've examined, I must say, not every time for many, many, many years, but many times over the years. There's no better way of getting a sense of it. It is a wonderful way of getting a sense of how registrars perform and feeling like you're really part of the system, giving back to our discipline. And as a supervisor, you know, really understanding what it's about. So I would encourage people to do it too. I really would, not just because we need good examiners, but it's a really good experience. Lastly, can I thank you both very much? Lovely to have you both. Thank you so much for giving your time, your expertise. So thanks for coming along. Thanks very much, Kate. Thanks, Beck, and we'll see you again soon.
Thank you so much. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and/or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.